Hello and welcome to Talking Scared. I'm your host, Neil McRobert, and today is a very special birthday for a very special lady. Carrie White, the bullied, burning, blood-soaked princess of our hearts and youths, turns 50 today. Yeah, April 5th, 1974. That's when Stephen King's debut was released upon the world, and, well, considering what's happened since, it may be the most important horror novel ever written. To commemorate this most auspicious of anniversaries, there's only two people I could really call. Nat Cassidy, author of Mary and Nestlings, and the only person I'm willing to admit knows more about Stephen King's work than me. And Ali Malenienko, author of Ghost Girl, Disappearing House, the forthcoming Broken Dolls. She's someone who understands better than most how youthful imagination really ticks. They rejoin me for another deep dive into King's back catalogue. We did a two-parter into It last year. And let's face it, we'll be doing these at least once a year forever, won't we? In this bumper conversation, we talk about empathy and monsters, about the horror of high school, wait till you hear the name of Nats. I wank on about some academic theory for the second week in a row, but mostly we talk about our abiding love for this book, both on its own merits and as a catalyst for the genre we all now live in. Don't worry, we're not too queasy in our adulation. We question, we nitpick, we gripe, but mostly this is a glass raised to the girl who burned so horror's female protagonist could live. Quick aside. At the time of recording this, I think my article on Carrie is coming out online from Esquire today. It includes some input from key writers like Margaret Atwood, Kat Ward, to name just two. If it does go live, I'll stick links on social media, so follow me over there at Talk Scared Pod on Twitter, Instagram, etc. And if you like this episode and want more bonus deep diving content, sign up for Patreon. Patreon.com/talkingscaredpod. All the money you pay goes to helping keep this show in your ears. And next up on that channel is myself and Nat talking about the other artistic North Star in our lives, Bruce Springsteen and his gothic imagination. But now, come with us to a high school gymnasium on a warm summer's night. The lights are soft, the music is swelling, and the prom queen of our dark hearts is ready to be crowned. Let's talk scared. Ali, Nat, welcome back to Talking Scared. The formality hardly seems necessary. We're old friends, but how are you?
I'm good. How are you guys?
It's so good to see you both and to be back in our deep diving submarine.
Time to go to prom.
I'm never not ready to talk about this book. I think I've already said to both of you and posted it out to the world, but I think this is maybe my 10th time reread, and I know it's even more for you, Neil. But yeah, I love that. I can always talk about this book.
I have no idea. I know for a fact I've read Misery the most, but I know I've read this a lot. I don't know how many times, but a lot of times. And it's amazing because I've still found new things in it. But we are recording this in advance, in February. But providing the world doesn't end in the next 6 or 7 weeks, which is, you know, to be fair, always a concern, people will hear this on the precise anniversary, 50 years to the day, after Carrie was first released upon the world. And I've been waiting for 2024 to roll around because I think it's going to be the start of like a wonderful sequence of celebrations, because every year now we get to fate the half centennial of at least one King classic, right? So I have 12 years to become famous enough to be the person they asked to do the big It forward, you know, in 2036.
You'll be there. That's plenty of time.
That's my guiding light now. Be the person who gets to write the foreword to the anniversary. But for now, it's Carrie, which I think is, you know, it's not a bad first book, is it?
Yeah.
No, he did pretty good. Not too bad. Not too shabby.
I find it hard to believe that there is anyone listening to this show who doesn't have a working knowledge of Carrie, because it's had 50 years and you're all horror fans, presumably. But it dawned on me, it could be like Dracula, where people think they know the story, but they actually have a misconception. That's possible. So I'm springing this on you, but as the synopsizer extraordinaire, Nat,
could I ask you to briefly introduce this book? You're so good at it.
God damn it. I figured Allie was going to do it this time. I didn't even think about it.
Nope, it's all you.
Okay, so there is a pet cemetery in Ludlow, Maine. And wait, no, I read the wrong book. Carrie, yeah, Carrie is Cinderella by way of Stephen King. It's about a bullied, beat upon, very unfortunate teenage girl, Carrietta White, born September 21st, Stephen King's birthday. What a coincidence. And she's just had a really rough go of her life and is kind of the sacrificial goat at her high school in, Chamberlain, Maine? Is that the name of the town? We never revisited it again in the Stephen King canon. But Chamberlain, Maine. And as the book tells us from the very first page, which I have thoughts on, she's picked upon, she's made fun of, but what the other girls don't know, what the other students don't know, is that Carrie White is telekinetic. And a horrible prank, to call it a prank is, I guess, putting too much forethought into it, but a horrible event happens to her in the showers one day, and she starts her period. She doesn't know what's happening. She's raised by a very religious, controlling mother, Margaret White, and so she's completely ignorant to her own body and the things that are happening. And the girls in the high school gym shower make fun of her, and they stone her with sanitary napkins and feminine products, and it's this very traumatic event, and it kickstarts a series of responses to that event. Some students who refuse to apologize, some students who feel really bad about it, one in particular named Sue Snell, who tries to make up for joining in the fun by having her boyfriend take Carrie to prom. Her boyfriend is like the quintessential popular kid. He does it. He takes Carrie to prom. A horrible event happens. Why am I avoiding spoilers? I'm avoiding spoilers in talking about this. The girls who, the one girl in particular, Chris, who's like kind of the main bully, or Henry Bowers, as it were, decides to dump some pig's blood onto Carrie at prom after Carrie is crowned queen. And that makes Carrie and her telekinesis go insane and get revenge on everybody. This is not my finest synopsis, but basically Cinderella goes to the ball. A prank is pulled on Cinderella and Cinderella kills everybody and then goes home. And kills her mom. See, my issue with synopsizing this book, and it's challenging because I was also thinking of how we're going to talk about this too, is that it's so much easier to synopsize something like It for some reason. This book is it's like 8 times shorter than It, but there's so much in it that we want to talk about, and there's so many different ways to describe it that it actually kind of, it baffles me to sort of concisely talk about it. Because do we talk about the religious aspects first? Do we talk about the physiological aspects first? The sociological aspects first? Do we talk about the story behind King writing it, which is also kind of fascinating? So like, you know, I try and pithily sum it up, but there's so much. There's so much, you guys. How do we wrap our hands around this 60,000 word novella?
Well, thankfully, I have sat down and I have made notes on how we'll proceed because for that exact reason. So when I do these episodes, when I do most episodes, I don't really plan the conversations out all that much. But this one, exactly that. You think it's going to be, oh, we'll talk for half an hour. It's a 60,000 page book about a fairly simple premise. You know, a girl is telekinetic and wreaks havoc when she's bullied. But there is so much in it and so much that I think you can see that are seeds of things to come back in King's later fiction as well. Margaret White, Mrs. Carmody, you know, things like that. The cruelty of children, the beauty of children, stuff like this. So much that recurs. So I've made a kind of plan, which we'll proceed through for about 20 minutes, and then it will go all over the place, let's face it. But I want to start with your, I don't know, first encounters with Carrie. Well, for a start, I'm going to say why I've invited you two to do this, because everyone assumes I've got you back just because we did the It one, right? But, you know, it's my podcast. I could have just said, right, you're done now, children. New people, please. But not only are you great at doing this because you're fans like I am, but also you both have, once again, a really useful perspective, because obviously, Ali, you know, you write books for a younger audience about younger characters and there's a whole conversation about whether this book is just incredibly brutal YA, you know? So obviously I wanted that younger perspective. I wanted, for God's sake, a female perspective, because the last thing the world needs is more men talking about this book. And Nat, you, for those who don't know, your first novel, Mary, I mean, it's a fairly unobscured retelling of Carrie, right? But from the other end of the feminine change, it's about you know, I thought the word escapes me. Why has my mind gone blank?
Menopause.
My God, I'm very tired, listeners. Well. It's about menopause. It's that same psychic threshold that comes from your book, and I want to talk about that as well, about the intersection of King and your first book. But you're a great panel to have this, right? To talk about this story. So let's start with your first reactions. Did you read this for the first time for this recording, Ali, or have you read it before?
No, I've read it before, but I haven't read it in a long time. So I did a recent reread,
right?
Because it had been a minute. And because I also, having seen the Sissy Spacek, always worry that I'm remembering things that might have been changed, and I'm not really remembering the book, maybe remembering the movie. Mm-hmm. So, but it's definitely not the first time.
And you've read it countless times now, but do you remember when you first read it?
I probably would have been 10 or 11. Mm-hmm. My first encounter with Carrie, which I actually go into a bit in the foreword to my book, Mary, my first encounter with Carrie was through the De Palma movie. And, you know, I used to wander around the video store looking at the horror art on the horror VHSs. And there was something about Sissy Spacek drenched in red with bright, wide, outraged eyes, which is an image that is taken directly from the book. Like, mm-hmm. he literally describes her as just all red with white eyes. That stuck in my head. It fucked me up so badly that I had to run to my mom and get her to like tell me what this story is about so I could like kind of compartmentalize it a little bit better. And for a long time when I was a little kid, because I was a latchkey kid, I was raised by a single mom who was working, and so I would be home alone by myself. When I was like, you know, 7 or 8 or 9, and I'd be home by myself, I was already huge into horror, so I was always scared. I was scaring myself, and I would think of Carrie being out to get me, and I would talk to her out loud as a little kid, and I would literally say things like, I'm sorry they were mean to you, please don't do anything to me, I'll be your friend. She became this weird sort of like matron saint for me of being home alone and scared.
Well, it's funny, the image of Sissy Spacek and wanting to know the plot, that mirrors my childhood. I've told both of these, they don't warrant the term anecdote, but both of these pieces of information before. One, people often ask me what my introduction to horror was. And that, I mean, you answer that question with what? I don't know. The first fairy tale you heard, right? They're all horror. But the first thing, horror with a capital H, I remember being on holiday with my dad when I would have been 8 years old. And all the holiday we were on, I would have been 8. And for some reason, because he was a very, very, very inappropriate, he's still alive. I always do that. I always say he was. He's still inappropriate. But He told me the plot of Carrie, and I was just captivated by this story about like what, you know, what horror can be. I suppose this world of adult horror I'd yet to access. Carrie was my entry point to that, and also I had a hardback that was it was Carrie and another book. I don't know what the other book was. It was a hardback, and they had like a reversible cover, and the front cover was a drawing, a cartoon style drawing of Sissy Spacek's blood soaked face, and it would look down. I had it on a shelf at the foot of my bed, and well into my teens, that book would freak me out. That image of Carrie's lifeless eyes staring down at Carrie haunted my childhood. But childhoods, Ali, you write for a younger audience, so from that perspective, having reread Carrie as a reader and as a writer for younger people, how, as a middle grade writer, what is your take on this book, I suppose, at the broadest level?
So I know people have talked about, like, is it maybe YA because it deals with high school age kids, but I don't read it like that. I read it as an adult book with young protagonists. I don't think it's actually geared, I mean, teenagers, obviously, like they're reading adult books, but I've never thought of it specifically as like, this is King's YA take. You know, I think it just, they just are younger people that are in it. Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's a successful depiction of young people, or do you think it's obviously a adult man's depiction of young people?
No, I think it's actually very good. And I am always extremely critical when men write teenage girls,
yeah,
because it's just a lived experience you sure don't have. And being a teenage girl is a thing. And I think he does a really good job with it, actually. Like, this is one of the books that I often, like, when discussing this, will point out that I think this is an adult man doing a very good job of getting into the heads of teenage girls.
It's so interesting to remember, too, that, like, he was so young.
He was so young.
He wrote this. He was 20. Like, Tabitha King wrote a great intro to one of the many editions of this book that I have. And she points out that, like, the way she phrases it is, we still had high school on our shoes. Like, we hadn't kicked high school, because he wasn't even 10 years out of high school. And he was teaching high school at the time. Yeah. So, like, he was, God, I mean, we're all of a certain age on this podcast now. And I look at, like, a 25-year-old and I'm like, you might as well be a high schooler. You are a child.
Child.
So he was still in that world and in that mindset, which you can feel coming off of this book in waves.
I think it's a remarkable book. And reading it again for this episode, I don't think I've ever been quite as impressed by it as I am this time around. I don't know what's changed, because certainly nothing has changed in my life to give me some extra perspective at all. I've always kind of, dismissed is too strong a word, but I've always relegated Carrie to being a sort of juvenile sort of footnote to his epics. It's like, it's the book you start with, but then there's not much traction there. There's not much weight to it, I used to think. And reading it again, like, if ever there's any doubt that King is, like, truly special as a writer, you know, not just good, but truly special, the fact that I'm able to reread such a slim book as Carrie and not only find it just compulsively readable, you know, on the 12th or so time, I read it in one day.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, I found genuinely new things in it that I hadn't found before. Like, the whole thing about whether Carrie is a product of marital rape, for example, is something I just had never picked up on, you know. That is, like, testament to greatness. And it's his first novel, like, his first book. And we'll get to how he writes about kids. I wanted to start with that, Ali, in case you were like, I have a problem. But we'll
No, I really don't. I really don't. I think he does a phenomenal job. Like I said, this is one of the few books where I'm like, he knows what he's doing. Like, he knows his characters.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, since, like, you said that, you know, he was still ingrained in high school. He was teaching kids of this age. I mean, I'm sure that contributed to it. But yeah, no, I do not have issue.
Just to complicate the picture a little bit, too, not to contradict what you're saying, Neil, but just to kind of add to it. It's his first published book. This was his sixth book that he wrote. The reason why I point that out, that he attempted to write books before, all about the same length. Like, he hadn't written, like, what we would think of as a full-length novel.
So we're talking, like, Rage, The Long Walk.
Yeah. The Body was actually, he had written an early version of The Body.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. The Pyhurst one, maybe.
Yeah. That would eventually become The Stand, weirdly. So he'd been trying to find his footing as a full-length novelist up until this point, but had been, like, finding the most actual professional success as a short story writer. And this book, to me, feels so much like a short story writer writing a novel, in very exciting ways. Like, I had already mentioned that first sentence being so remarkable to me. It's not the first sentence. That's incorrect of me. I apologize. But that one sentence on the first page, front-loading the plot so economically.
And they say something like, what they didn't know, of course, is that Carrie White was telekinetic.
Yeah, what they didn't know, of course, was that she was telekinetic. That, to me, is such an interesting clue into this period of development for him. Because, like, when you look at his short stories of that time, you know, like the Night Shift era short stories, they're very EC Comics classical horror stories. They're written like jokes. You know, they've got a setup and a punchline. They're very Richard Matheson. They're very Charles Beaumont. They're very Ray Bradbury. And of course, like, he was writing to a market. He wasn't just writing for himself. He was trying to sell these stories to skin magazines and whatnot. They had a strict word count, and people would expect a certain thing. And so there's setup, punchline, very clearly, like, here's what the story's about. Here's how it's going to be subverted by the end. This book does that too. Like, it is written with an economy to it that none of his other works really have. So it is like kind of anomalous in his body of work. And I feel like, you know, any other, even you can even look at like Salem's Lot, which comes out the next year. It's his second novel, and that is much more of a full length novel. How long does Salem's Lot take to even mention vampires or to give us what this book is about? It takes a long goddamn time. But Carrie is just like, all right, here's what it's about. And it's almost more a book about an event than it is about characters. But as he's writing and telling the story, you can almost see him realizing like, oh, I love writing about character. And like, that's where he like really shines, and no pun intended, where you can really see that specialness that you've already alluded to.
I love the backstory to it. I think there are two great stories about stories in horror, and you have The Birth of Frankenstein in the Villa Diodati, you know, in the banks of Lake Geneva, where I used to live for a while, hoping for the same inspiration and never got it. And I used to live just down the road from the Villa Diodati. And I used to think, come on, Byron, channel something into me. Come on, Mary. Never happened. but, you know, there's that story about the ghost story competition in the year without a summer and all of that stuff. That's the great origin myth in horror. And then, you know, 170 years later, you have the story of Carrie, which is the fact that he started writing it, got to the scene with Carrie's period and realized, well, thought that he couldn't write about teenage girls, threw the book away. And then Tabitha, all hail Tabitha King.
Our queen.
Yep. Dredged it from the garbage pail. And here we are now. So it really is to me the second great textual origin story. And particularly with what's happened after. That it feels like one of those sliding doors moments where what if he had gone on and written another short story for Playboy or Hustler, and maybe it would never have happened. Maybe he would never have had the advance that he got to then have the relaxation he had to write Salem's Lot the way he did. You know, because that's the sense I get. Mm-hmm. I feel like in this story, in Carrie, he is sprinting towards the end because he wants to sell this fucking book, right? He wants a short story. I mean, in my foreword that I've got, he's talking about how he just sold Graveyard Shift to Cavalier or somebody like that, and they paid him $200. And he was like, I really didn't have time to write a novel that may not sell because I had to pay the bills, and stories paid the bills. And there's a feeling that this is a story that's got out of hand and he wants to sell it. And he sold it for something like $400,000. And it feels like that gave him the immediate chance to go, okay, I can now tell stories I really always wanted to tell. And then we got everything after. And I just love the sense that kind of swung on a dime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I've compared King to the Beatles in a lot of ways, in like as a sort of like that level of pop culture contribution and icon status. You can almost drive yourself crazy thinking about how, like, you know, would the Beatles have actually been as big as they are? Would Beatlemania have happened if the Kennedy assassination hadn't happened a few months earlier? And like people really needed something to like lift their spirits. America really wanted something to kind of delight in. And Kennedy shot in November and the Beatles are on Ed Sullivan in February. And like just the timing works beautifully.
Yeah.
And you look at the way the horror market was before Carrie, and it was just waiting for something like this. It was, you know, we've had Rosemary's Baby, we've had The Exorcist, and we've had the other, Tom Tryon's the other. Yeah. Those are like the big three pre-Carrie horror books that were creating this market that was kind of hungry for, you know, one author to really like become a figurehead of it. And Carrie comes out right after The Exorcist movie, like, you know, barely a year after The Exorcist movie. It happens to also be about a kid, a teenager. So like the audience is kind of there. And even like, you know, in my rambling attempt at describing it as like a short story writer's novel, Like, I don't think we would get Carrie, the Carrie that we know and love and that became like such an icon and such a doorbuster, if he hadn't have tried to have written Rage before Carrie.
Oh, I never thought about that connection.
Yeah, I mean, it's for those that don't know, Rage is an earlier novella, earlier novel. And that was the one that he actually sent to Bill Thompson, who would eventually become his editor. That was like the one he was proud of. And it's about a school shooter, basically. It's about another claustrophobic horror that happens at a high school. So this was like clearly the sort of stuff that was on his mind. When you read the prom scene now, you can't not think of, you know, of the hostage scenes in Rage as like a dry run.
Getting it on.
Yeah, and it's called Getting It On. The original title was Getting It On. And Billy, when he is in the Cavalier Roadhouse with Chris and Carrie, even says, like, we got it on. Like, there's just, like, so much of King's attempts at writing this kind of story first in this book. Like, it just feels like this perfect storm, this confluence of things that were waiting to happen. And the market was right, and he, the time of his life was right. His wife just happened to be like walking by and looked in his trash can and saw these pages. And she's even said, like, I don't normally read his trash. Like, I'm just, in her intro to that edition of Carrie, she even says, like, I just happened to be a really fast reader. And I looked down and I read it really fast and I was like, oh, this is something. So yeah, you're totally spot on. Like, it's such a beautiful, almost like parthenogenic sort of kickstart of this new era of horror.
That's a great entry point, because we've talked now for 25 minutes and basically waffled about the broader principles. Let's talk about high school. Let's get into it, because from afar, via pop culture, American high schools seem to be simultaneously sepia-toned and also an absolute pit of vipers. I have no actual real-life perspective. I'm talking about, you know, everything from the OC onwards has kind of informed my view of American high school.
The documentary series, the OC.
Yeah. And I don't want to sort of pick any very loosely healed wounds here. But what were your high school experiences like? And is King's High School, is Chamberlain High anything like what a real high school ecosystem is?
So my high school experience was I think pretty average for most teenage girls. I was in the drama club, I was kind of nerdy, I definitely had a bully, but I feel like the school that he's created and this world that he's created there, I feel like it tracks well towards what my high school experience was like. I don't know. What do you think, Nat?
I had a weird high school experience in that my high school was massive. It was 4,000 students at least.
Wow.
Like, it was, yeah. So it was like almost too big to have identifiable hierarchies. There were cliques, there were communities, but it was basically like a fucking college campus in some ways. You know, there were definitely within those communities, within those like smaller social spheres, there were hierarchies of their own. There was a pecking order. Mm-hmm. What this actually makes me think of more is, for me, was middle school. And my middle school was, I know it's different for every state, but for me, it was just 7th and 8th grade. It was just two years.
That was mine.
Yeah. That feels right. Those are like the two worst years. You want to isolate those years.
Yes.
In their own building.
In their own miserable building.
Yeah. And I went to Desert Shadows Middle School in Arizona.
I'm sorry. What? Desert Shadows Middle School.
Desert Shadows. Yeah. I went to Desert Shadows Elementary School too.
Did they teach you the fine art of necromancy? I mean.
Oh, of course. Of course. But we weren't paying attention because we were fucking preteens.
Desert Shadows Middle School. Things.
Yeah, with a little saguaro as its icon.
Yeah.
But the reason why I specifically think of middle school is we weren't allowed to have lockers in middle school because it's not that we didn't have lockers. We had locker bays. And, you know, because this is out west, like they were outside. We had these external locker bays, and they were shuttered the whole time I went there because the girls would slam each other's heads in the lockers or would occasionally, like, you know, trap each other's ponytails in them and then lock them. They were so physically violent in their bullying, more so than the boys. Like, the boys, we would get into, like, fist fights or, you know, spit on each other or something like that. But the girls would fucking destroy each other's. It was a level of animosity and rage that made the school shutter lockers for everybody. And when I read books like Carrie or stories like Carrie, that's immediately what I think of, was just like how not just cruel it is as an ecosystem in general, but specifically how mean the girls were at that
Let's
age
talk about
to each
mean
other.
Girls.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Mean Girls, because like Sue is such a fascinating character because I think, you know, Sue participates and then feels bad about participating and doesn't understand why she participated. And I'm like, baby, I get it. I get why you participated, because you are young and you already know that the world hates girls and women. And to cozy up to the patriarchy, you also hate girls and women. Like, you pick on each other because that keeps you safe in a way that defending each other does not. Mm. And like that, like, we've all done it. Like, I have been cruel and I've been picked on. Like, I don't think there are very few girls or adult women in this world who haven't had that experience. And like I said, I personally think it's because you've internalized all of this misogyny, but you don't understand how the patriarchy works. So you just know that there's something inherently bad about being a girl. Hmm. There's something gross about being a girl. You know, and I feel like it's just so well handled in this book, the way she just joins in and then is like, why did I do that? Like, I don't even have bad feelings about Carrie. Like, she never did anything to me. Like, why would I have done that? And I just, yeah, I think it's just written so sensitively and just so well done.
I have thoughts on Sue that I think may not be popular, but I'll get to that in a bit.
The thing
we need to talk about, there's no point putting off the conversation about the big scene. And unlike so many books, the big shocking scene in Carrie is not the conclusion, where she reigns like essentially she's a walking nuclear bomb. That isn't the big talking point. The big talking point is the opening scene, which Nat alluded to and which you're alluding to, Ali, in which Carrie gets what we find out is her first period, even though she's 16 going on for 17. And she's freaked out like hell because she thinks she's dying because her mother has never taught her what's happening to her. And these girls turn into a kind of baying mob and start pelting her with sanitary towels and, what's the refrain? That is it? Plug it up. They start shouting at her and stuff. It's horrible, and it's more horrible the more grown up I get. Because I think when I first read this, I don't know, probably like 12, something like that, I was an obnoxious little boy who was kind of had the reaction of, "Ooh, period's disgusting. Oh, isn't it?" And like laughing along with these girls. And now I read it, and it's just like absolute.
It's the cruelest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, we need to talk about it. I think we might as well get it out of the way early doors. So what's your reaction to that scene now? I mean, just thoughts. And also, do you remember what it was like when you first read that scene or first saw the film or first became aware of that scene? Because it's quite a scene, even now, let alone when it was written.
So I'm trying to remember what my first... I think my first reaction would have been from the film, because I saw that before I read the book. And I recall just being like, I was horrified for her, but at the same time I was like, well, you did this to yourself. Like I kind of blamed Carrie a little bit for like not knowing, and for like, it's like, well, of course they're gonna pick on you. Like, you put, you know, you're screaming that you're dying. Like, of course they're gonna all pick on you. But now, like, as an adult, like, I think they're all horrible and I have nothing but compassion for her. It's because, you know, it is like, if you're not expecting that, it's extremely scary. It's a scary thing to go through the first time, even knowing that this is going to happen. it's still a scary thing to go through. So not knowing that you were going to get your period, like, that's terrifying. I would have thought I was dying too.
It's a weird thing to read as a guy because there is still such a veil around menstruation that obviously now I'm old enough, I know how it works on a you know, bodily level because, well, it'd be kind of weird if I didn't, right? But there is still such a cultural veil around it that there are so few depictions of it in culture. There's so little insight that even now I'm a little bit like, I don't really understand what's going on. So I can kind of empathize with Carrie a little bit because it's a mystery to me, you know, in any kind of meaningful way. So I wonder maybe if it's easier, this is a really weird thing to suggest, if it's easier in that situation to empathize with Carrie as a guy than it is as a girl who, you know, that situation and you can kind of think like, come on, Carrie, come on, you know, do yourself a favor here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I definitely think it would be easy for you to empathize than it is for me because it's just, you know, I mean, it's just the thing is like menstruation has been like avoided or feared in like nearly every culture for all of time. Like it's the whole the physical act of it, which like is hard for you guys to understand because the overriding question is how do you bleed for 5 days and not die? You know, like how does that work? And it's just like, I think it just really contributes to this idea that women are their bodies, their being, their whole identity has like an untrustworthiness to it. Mm. Like it's a little too witchy. I think that watching that scene, you know, when I was younger, I definitely, you know, obviously I had a working knowledge of periods since I was in like third grade, you know. But watching that when I was younger, I definitely like, I struggled. I mean, I felt bad for her, obviously, but I was like, Carrie, get it together. Come on.
Yeah. There's, and the fact that it happens in the shower too, is an interesting kind of contrapuntal image because I think one of the reasons why anything having to do with bodily excretions is looked at as like, you know, taboo and disgusting and, you know, not factoring in the very valid points that you've also already articulated, Allie, but just even like looking at it from a just bodily fluid sort of place, they're in this clean environment, they're showering, they're bathing, which, you know, from one perspective can be very titillating, it can be very arousing, it's, you know, it's steamy, it's special, oh my god, it's lovely, and so to like see filth, to see excretion is not right. It is like animalistic. There's something very base and vulgar about it. And one thing that really struck me through this read through, this most recent read through, is that the language is just steeped in animalistic imagery.
Yeah.
Like at one point, he even says that Carrie turns her head bovinely.
Yes.
But she's like she's described as a cow, as a hog, as a frog,
ox-like at one point. That's the one that got
ox-like.
Me.
Ox-like. Yeah, I wrote it.
Ox-like.
Goat, an ape.
Yeah.
And much references made to her acne and her weight. So there's just like the narrative lens is also just kind of telling us, look how gross this is.
Yeah.
And that it's happening in this place of cleanliness and
feminine beauty and pristine
water, feminine beauty. Yeah. Like, it just makes it all the more, I think there's a reason why, it's so easy to fall into judging Carrie in this, because so much of this novel is from the outside in. So much of this novel is looking at Carrie instead of being in her head. And so he does such a great job of eliciting that disgust in all of us and like from a very primal place.
Yeah.
Are you, either of you aware of Julia Kristeva?
I don't, it doesn't ring a bell.
No.
So Julia, this is where I get nerdy. I like to get my little nerd hat on sometimes.
This is where you get nerdy?
So Julia Kristeva, she's a literary critic, like a semiotician theorist, you know, one of those Frederick Jameson types who I ran away from academia, but she had a theory she wrote a book called The Powers of Horror, and she has this term, the abject, which has become kind of a proper noun in critical theorist, French theorist circles. And it, to be honest, it's been years, and the finer points of this elude me. But from what I can remember, the abject tends to focus on things that human beings expel, and our reaction to those things, our reaction to the excreta that you talk about, you know. And the idea is, and this is where it gets really, really woolly, the idea is that things like vomit and, you know, shit and piss and sperm and all of this stuff that we have a sort of knee-jerk cultural response to, it's the idea that they are in, they some way represent a collapse between the subject, ourselves, and the other, that is which is outside ourself. So it's kind of like the self and the other, the subject and the object, and that collapsing thing is a cause of disgust. And that's her theory that has been taken on by many, many horror scholars as to why we are so repulsed, and also why we use these things to repulse. And I have never read a better manifestation of that, a better distillation than that opening scene of Carrie, in the fact that this thing is leaving her. She thinks she's dying. It has meaning that it is outside herself, but also corrupts the thing which has left her body, has corrupted her sense of self, even though it's no longer part of her. And these girls are like, they become, it's almost like they smell something in the air. It's almost like a pheromonal thing that they cannot withstand the disgust. It's awful what they do, but there is a real sense in that opening chapter that it's no reflection of their character. It's just an absolute reflex reaction to something that is happening to them. It's like if you threw blood into a, you know, a tank full of sharks, they would go into a frenzy. They wouldn't. It's not an ethical choice the shark is making. And I feel like it just took me back to reading Julie Kostreva and The Abject in ways I hadn't thought about for like 10 years. It's so perfect.
Interesting. The blood drop at prom does the same thing. Like the laughter starts almost unwillingly.
Yeah.
And like it's uncomfortable laughter that then just kind of, you know, like a brush fire spreads out.
She talked about how like they all just start, they couldn't stop laughing. Like there was nothing to do because it's like when you tip so far into being horrified that like that's just your body has to do something. And they all just start laughing.
Yeah.
And they're disturbed by their own laughter, aren't they? They don't enjoy it. They're horrified by their own inability to be. And there's a whole thing there, I think, about being pubescent and not having control of your body and your faculties in this book as well. I think it's a lot of tussling with that about you aren't actually in control of a lot of your own behavior, whether it's peer pressure or hormonal stuff or various drives. You're not really in control, and it's not really fair to judge people by their actions within reason, you know, at that time. I think there's a lot about self-control in this book. I don't know if King is just really genius and he's exploring this in a really calculated way, or whether he's just, like you say, 5 minutes out of high school and just writing from the viscera, you know, writing from the nerve endings. Like that's what we call the episode with King, that he's just writing from a place that's almost non-intellectual. It's just he just knows this is what the reality of that situation would be. If you put this girl in a high school, that's what would inevitably happen.
Yeah, I would agree. Like there's something that's very documentarian about this book, which again, like, is something that makes it a bit of an outlier in his body of work. It's documentarian in its structure, but it's also it takes so long for us to get Carrie's point of view. Mm-hmm. And then even at prom, you know, again, like some of this is just like really brilliant structure as far as suspense goes. But I think it also belies, you know, what his priorities were while writing it. So even during prom, like, we don't get her perspective of the blood drop until several chapters later. And we don't get her perspective of the shower until several chapters later. It's all about other people witnessing it first. Yeah. I think it means something on a number of levels at the very, 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 very final moments of the book for Carrie is someone finally in her head, that, you know, she and Sue have this very, very eventually Stephen King like connection, scene of like having this psychic conversation. And like, that's really, It's only at the final moments of her life when someone is actually like sharing her perspective for the first time. And like, that makes what you just said so extra poignant, that like, we reject these outsiders, these excreters, out of a like almost immune response to empathy.
Well, and I think also if you start empathizing, then it's also, you run the risk of becoming othered.
Yeah.
You know, like, you will get outed from the group. It's not safe.
Of course, we are also forced to come up against the idea that even now, 50 years after King wrote this scene, menstruation is still incredibly taboo in culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've only got to look at, you know, have either of you two seen Saltburn?
No, not yet.
I haven't seen it yet.
Right. Well, I adored it for reasons. That's a whole other episode. What people hate it, people love it. I think it's a brilliant movie. But there is a scene in it. There are three scenes. There are three scenes that are kind of the ones where everyone goes, oh, that scene. Oh, and that scene. And the middle of the three scenes, because I won't spoil them for you because they are quite eyebrow raising. This guy basically goes down on this girl and she's on a period. And he reaches up with his sort of fingers covered in menstrual blood and like smears them on her face. And I'm watching it. My wife was just kind of like, just cringing. And I was like, do you understand how many times I've seen blood smeared on a girl's face in a movie I'm watching? Do you understand that is like every second film I see, there's a girl with blood all over her face, right? And I just find it insane that even in horror, where blood is the primary aesthetic of the culture, but not that blood. It can't be that blood. Mm-hmm. Oh, we can have the blood that the clown literally carves out of the girl's abdomen. That's fine.
That's fine.
But we can't have the actual bodily process that
human
she goes through.
Biological process. Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, I don't have an answer. There's anthropological arguments for this that go back millennia. I don't have the answer, but I don't get why, even in our little blood-soaked genre, even we consider this stuff taboo.
I think it's just a general not wanting to know, you know, that the culture in general has about women's bodies. You know, I think it's just, you know, Carrie becomes like an allegory for female vengeance, you know, against the patriarchy, which, you know, shamed women for the very menstrual cycles that were responsible for the existence of every member of the patriarchy. That's how you're all here. That's the only way it works. And it still is just something that people can't handle. And I don't have an answer for why. Like I said, the most I come back to is that it's the only example where you will continuously bleed and be fine. You know? And I just think that there's that untrustworthiness about it. Makes you sort of not human. And I don't know.
Well, I just think this. I just think, you know, if you're listening to this and you watch Terrifier and Terrifier 2 and you watch Saw and you watch all of these things that we watch, and if you're sitting there and you're thinking, ooh, menstrual blood, that's disgusting, have a fucking word with yourself.
I agree.
But what King does so brilliantly, I mean, I think the greatest sleight of hand in this book is he reveals the bully inside of all of us. When I was at school, I always objected to bullying. I was always used to put a stop to it at school because I wasn't some angel, but I hated it. But I've met people who are, you know, so abject, so vulnerable, so pathetic that some awful antenna that we have, it does respond to the inner victim. And obviously we all try not to act upon that, but I don't know whether you recognize that. And I do recognize the impulse that King invokes in us through Carrie, though, because I feel like we do take on the POV of the bully sometimes in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think that's also because, as Nat was saying, you spend so much more time looking at Carrie than hearing from Carrie. So you're consistently shown this, like, this idea of her as being abhorrent and deserving of the bullying that she gets.
One of the times he's written about this book, it might have even been in On Writing, he describes how like the inspiration for this story came from two girls mm-hmm. when he was also in school. And one of them was just this poor girl who, you know, literally poor girl who always only wore one outfit to mm-hmm. school. And then one day she showed up in a new outfit and she was so proud. And everybody made fun of her even worse. Mm-hmm. And he points out that he didn't join in on it, but kind of exactly like what you're saying, Neil. And I know I've been in this position too, and I'm sure we all have. He didn't stop it. Hmm. He just kind of watched it happen and felt really bad about it. I think that's part of the reason why Sue Snell is, of all the characters in this book, like the most dynamic, the most vibrant, the most, you know, artfully sketched. She really is kind of the prime point of view sort of character in this story, because that's I think King's stand-in in this book, is like, that's the character who witnesses it, kind of joins in, but is also like, why am I doing this? Mm. I should be better than this. I find her character to be really fast. I think Sue is the best part of this book, and I am very curious to hear your takes on it,
Neil. I do too, so spill it, Neil.
I was going to talk about Carrie first, but okay, Sue, I don't really like her. I don't think I would like her if I knew her in real life. I think she's a very real character. I don't think she's a badly written character at all. I agree with you. She's the most dynamic. She has the most tumultuous inner life. So it's not an issue of craft, this. It really sounds like we're trying to appease King in case he listens. I'm genuinely not doing that. But it's not an issue of how well she's written. I don't like her because I know people like her, or I've known people like her. I will just say at the start, the name Sue Snell is the most damning name since Uriah Heep. Like, she sounds like some kind of brown-nosing do-goody, tell the teacher Snell. On you. Sue Snell. Yeah. That's how I... So, of course, she's not a villain at all. But I do get why people around her consider her actions holier than thou. And I think even Tommy, her boyfriend, because you said this, but just to reiterate it, Sue, in sort of penance for taking part in the bullying of Carrie, asks her jock quarterback boyfriend to take Carrie to the prom, which is, as always struck me, is a slightly ludicrous plot device, a bit of a deus ex machina that I can never fully get on board with. But I get it, there had to be something that orchestrated what happened, so it's fine. I think something about Sue and her motivations rings false. And it's something that King also acknowledges, because right at the end, when Sue finds Carrie's dying body, Carrie is rifling through Sue's head, and she talks about this sort of psychological filing cabinet, which comes back in Dr. Sleep and the battle between Abra
and Dreamcatcher.
And yeah. So like I said, there's a lot of precursors here. And there's the hint there, or more than hint, that it's born out of something that's not entirely altruistic. So I think there's a vanity and a sort of performative penance to what Sue is doing, which never feels to me like it's born out of goodness.
In her defense, though, she says that about herself, too.
That's what I was just going to say. Like, she knows.
Well, that's what she would say, isn't it?
She just can't win.
She admits that she worries that this is not genuine and that she's doing it so it's performative, so that everyone sees what a good person she is. Yeah. You know, I mean, she blatantly says that. And I do think that that's true. I think a lot of it is performative. But also, you know.
What at that age isn't?
Exactly. She's a teenage girl. You know?
The thing that makes me like her the most is when she's an adult and it's during, or no, she's not even an adult. Oh, she might be. I forget if it's from the White Commission transcripts or if it's from her book. But she points out, I can't remember exactly how she says it, but she says, like, I don't want you people thinking Carrie was a monster. And that to me is a moment of actual genuine empathy. Like, she wrestles with her own motives and stuff like that, but at one point in the book she stops everything dead in its tracks and says Carrie was not the villain in this story. And that to me makes her worthy of praise, of being respected. I mean, teenage Sue Snell, I think you're exactly right, and she's a fascinating 180 from Chris, the bully, because both of them use sex for manipulation. They both manipulate their men into doing the bad thing. Like, they're both manipulative as hell. But Sue is the one who is wrestling with her role in this and trying to, like, find out who she is and what actually is worth doing, what is moral, what is right. And she has the clarity to say that it's not Carrie who is the one who's ultimately to blame for kind of what Carrie does. Like, I don't even know if I fully agree with her, given this is a bit of a tangent. I apologize. But to me, like, the one major difference between Carrie in the movies and Carrie in the book is that Carrie in the book comes back.
Yes.
Like, Carrie in the book does not stand on stage bloody and then things start happening. She runs away and then she's like, no, I'm going to make these motherfuckers pay. And so, like, in a way, Sue is almost giving Carrie more empathy than even Carrie might deserve. And I find that to be a very fascinating distinction.
I want to come back to that about Carrie coming back. But what about you, Alan, before we move on? I don't want to... What's your thoughts on Sue? Because you seem to think that I was wrong as well.
It's not that I think you're wrong. I think Sue is an extremely realistic character. I feel it's what I would have done, too. Like, I can recognize younger me in Sue. And I just... I think her compassion when she's older is really like a driving point in this story, because like she's the only voice saying this is a teenage girl. This is a little girl that we have abused. Like, yes, she did horrible things, but also a little bit, well, what did you think was going to happen? Like, people break if you keep trying to break them. Like, what did you know? So I like Sue. I think Sue's all right.
What I will say is I think Sue is a participant in King's best sex scene. Now, I say this having just reread Carrie, so the said sex scene is fresh in my brain. So I'm probably forgetting, you know, 20 other sex scenes that could take it, you know, to church. But the scene right at the start, it's almost immediately after the shower room scene where we get the quick jump from Carrie's loneliness, you know, walking home to her, we'll get to her house and all that. That's where the real locus of horror. But you get this leap from that to it's a parking lot and Sue is in the back seat with Tommy having also 1970s teenage sex. And but there's this, well, basically people often decry sex scenes and especially King's sex scenes, right? But in that scene, in all the kind of awkward fumbling, there is so much great character work. King loves to do this thing, right, where when people are in the throes of great emotion or great physical feeling, it becomes like a fragment of thoughts and images, you know. So as she's approaching orgasm, she starts having all these thoughts and it's like fragments and fleeting stream of consciousness, like almost quite Beckett type stuff. And she just sees this future of complete conformity. Because, of course, she's just conformed to the bullying in the shower room. And now she sees a lifetime of conformity where she ends up just being this very suburban housewife. Again, the very 70s darkness of that in an era when people just... conformity is the most terrifying thing they can imagine. I wonder, actually, when King was writing that, because this idea about conformity is such a through line in the book... because Carrie is conforming in a way to her mother's will. Her mother wants to conform to God's will, even though it's the opposite of social conformity. There's so many layers of what it means to conform. I do wonder if in the writing of this, King was tussling with the idea that he may never make it, that he may always just be a guy who wrote stories and did a 9-to-5 and tried to make ends meet, and he would never make it. And not necessarily this was his last chance, but whether he was having those very quarter-life crisis thoughts that he put into Sue, who is the sort of shining light of the book. And if anyone's going to get out, she is. And the thought that she might not. And I think all of that is done in like 3 pages of quite awkward teenage sex. I think it's just the most brilliant little sequence.
Maybe you do like Sue Snell. Maybe you're coming around to her as a character.
Oh my God, I am Sue Snell.
What is the name of her book too? Is like, My Name is Sue Snell or something like that.
It's yes,
like
very, yes.
Yeah, so we all are Sue Snell. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very poignant way to look at it. I find that scene fascinating too, because like, in some ways, it smacks a little bit of the time in which it was written. I think I don't even know if I fully agree with myself as I'm saying this, but like, I know when I read it, sometimes like it makes me think of, you know, oh, of course, it's the character who doesn't quite enjoy sex, that she is the noble one. She's the one that, you know, we're supposed to think is the good person. Whereas Chris is just like fucking nonstop and she fucks for pleasure. Like there is like a very patriarchal look at, you know, the distinction between these two characters, who I think are supposed to be, you know, opposite poles. We're supposed to look at them as kind of mirror images of
yes,
each other.
Yeah.
And of course, Sue is the one who like just doesn't quite like it. She just does. But on the other hand, like Tabitha, again, in her intro, makes a very great point about how achieving a female orgasm takes patience, and it takes consideration, and it takes time. And that is not something that teenage boys are known to have in any supply. And so like, it's almost like she doesn't quite belong in the backseat with, like, she's not going to find pleasure in this act, because she's actually someone who, you know, will require someone who's a little more considerate and adept. I think it does kind of speak to a maturity, all of which is to say it speaks to a maturity of her as a character, I think. Mm. And yeah, I wouldn't be surprised, because like, I think already it's, at least to me at least, so clear that Sue is King's stand-in, that she's probably giving voice to some of his of his neuroses. I wouldn't be surprised.
But she does come in the back of the car.
Yes, and it's small. It's small. But she starts to feel it.
Yeah, but it's when she's managed to put to bed briefly the idea of her own guilt over what's happened with Carrie.
Right.
So again, it's right. about
yep.
it's about her having to somehow overcome the orgasm blocker that her is her own, you know, compliance in that act. So, yeah, I don't know. I need to rethink soon.
That scene is also, I think, one of the only times I've noticed Stephen King reference Frank Zappa. So, like, that pops out to me too. Susie Cream Cheese, she calls herself, which is a Zappa reference, and I was like, oh,
okay, not quite that nerdy. Yeah, not quite that nerdy. Now, the one thing I haven't asked you guys is what you think about Carrie. Because we've talked about how Carrie is not always, but often at a distance in this book. You know, because what we haven't made clear for those who haven't read it, if you've only seen the film, for example, this book is a collage of texts. It's not straightforward narration. You get a lot of omniscient third person from Sue's perspective. You get actually very close third person from Carrie's perspective. Very, 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 very brief bit from Chris and Billy, and some from Margaret White. But a lot of the book is a collage of pseudo-academic texts. And, you know, if you made it these days, it would be Wikipedia entries, right? It's that kind of thing. It's that full documentation thing. So a lot of it is keeping Carrie as a sort of butterfly or a sort of dark moth under a microscope. She's not a character. She's an object for a lot of the narration. And I mean, I do wonder why he wrote it that way, and we can talk about that, but I also want to talk about what you think about Carrie. Let's do the format first. Does that appeal to you? What do you think it adds to the story? Do you think would it be a better story without it? Why do you think he wrote it that way? It's a bold move, right, for a first book.
It is a bold move. Yeah, it is a bold move. I don't necessarily feel like it adds to the story. I mean, I think there were ways to share all of the information that he shares within the actual story. And I remember when I first read it, I found it really distracting. Like, yeah. I was definitely taken out of the narrative. But it didn't, this time around, it didn't, I guess because I knew it's there, you know. It didn't bother me this time around. I think it's, I can't for the life of me, have a reason for why. Because it's, like you said, it's extremely bold. On a first novel, I'm surprised an editor wasn't like, yeah, what is all of this?
He was writing it at an era of like, there's quite a lot of postmodern stuff flying around back then.
Yeah. But
that always seems to be a thing that King booked against rather than embracing the sort of
right.
the stuff you would discuss like I do in literary seminars. He always seems to like have an actual aversion to that, but he seems to take it on in this book. What, you know, I said about noticing things for the first time, this is the first time that I realized this book is set in the future when he wrote it.
Yes. Yeah. This was the first time I realized that too. Same. I'm like, it's later than he's currently writing. Like, why?
Yeah.
It's like, what, four yeah. years later?
Well, 1979.
Why? What?
I don't know.
What one entry goes through to 85. At the end, the thing, the little hanging thread, then he's not in 85. I can only think that he wanted to somehow construct a narrative in which this could be real. You know, that, okay, it's, you've got the falseness of time travel, but in this world in which things happen in the future, this actually, there's still space for it to happen for real, because otherwise it would have happened if he'd written it in 1970. You know what I mean?
Right.
But yeah, I don't. It that again seemed a bold thing, because it seems like it could obviously date the book, because by 1985, who knows, TK could have been outed, the TK gene, even.
Yeah.
But I like the little collage of text and the faux documentary stuff, because I'm into metafiction. I'm into that kind of fake, what is truth, what is fiction. I'm into all of that sort of stuff. So I liked it. But I think a lot of writers would have done it and done the entire thing in that format, where King is then just like, oh no, here's just some third person narration because I want to tell you a story. And he can't resist it. He can't, you know. But yeah, it keeps Carrie at a distance. And what I'm interested in is, what are your thoughts on Carrie? I tweeted when I was about a third of the way through the book, and I said, whilst we pity her, we never love her. And then I carried on reading and realized I was wrong. By the time it gets to her being invited to the prom and the heartbreak of her vulnerability and the bravery of saying yes, the bravery mm-hmm. of saying yes to Tommy.
And the whole way she says yes. Like, the whole way she says yes, she's like, you know, I want to go. Like,
you know, you knew I would. You knew
you
I would.
You knew I would. That's what it is. You knew I would.
The power he has by asking her.
She can't say no. Yeah. There's no world in which she cannot go. And I just, I love that. I think Carrie's probably, I mean, you know, I feel like I'm interrupting you. Were you done?
No, yeah. I'm done. I've talked enough.
I think that I still, and maybe this is incredibly disturbing of me to say, I still don't see her as a villain. Like, I understand that she does something villainous, but it is only done in response to every person in her life abusing her. And I just feel like, you know, you all asked for this. Like I said before, you keep trying to break someone, eventually they will. And then whatever happens after that, like, you did this. Like, nobody had to put this much energy onto Carrie. I mean, it's a little different with her mother, because we can talk about the whole, like, religious extremism thing. But, like, you, in my opinion, the bullies created their own monster, you know? And she did what I think anyone with the ability to do it would do. Like, that moment she has when she's like, no, I'm going to go back. I was like, mm-hmm, that's right, you go back. Like, I fully, I don't think she's a villain, which is probably going to get me canceled.
She's the monster in the tower, and they are the villagers with pitchforks, right? That's what it is.
Yes.
I never, just so you know you're in safe hands, I never for a second considered Carrie to be the villain. That thought has never entered my head that she's the villain. I think she's no more the villain than Frankenstein's monster is the villain of that book. You know, again, the link to Frankenstein. There are some, quite a lot of connections there. Because earlier I said that this book is a lot about the lack of control that teenagers have or could be required to have. Quick aside, I worked for a while in youth offending here in the UK. It was only an admin role, but I worked alongside a lot of probation officers. And there was a lot of scientific research being done at the time about the development of teenage brains. It was all often in boys, because we only worked with male offenders. And there was basically proof that the average male brain doesn't fully mature until 21 to 25. So how can you really punish someone mm-hmm. when their brain isn't built yet to handle a situation? You know, a lot of debate about that. I think this book is all about teenagers' inability to behave and control their behavior. And if we're going to forgive a mob of teenage girls for throwing sanitary towels at a screaming peer because that's their power, and we're going to forgive them for giving vent to their worst power, then you've got to ask the question, what would they have done in that situation if they had TK?
Right.
All Carrie is doing is exerting the power she has. And it just happens to be a damn sight more fucking nuclear than what the girls can do. But it's kind of the same ethical balance. You know, it's the same ethical, like, I don't know, standard, I think. It's people exerting what meager power they have in that point in their life and doing the best, doing the damage they can do, because that's what their bodies are telling them to do, basically. She's not a villain. She's a teenage girl who's just terrifyingly powerful. Are you going to say you hated that? Are you going to say, burn the witch?
Yes, I'm the most puritanical of us all. For me, it's not even a question of loving her. It is a question of whether this is an empowering story or a tragic story. And for me, it's a deeply tragic story. Like, I don't know if I love Othello as a character. I don't know if I love Hamlet as a character. I watch their stories and I go, fuck, like, get off of this ride. Like, this is breaking my heart that this is how it is happening. Mm. And that to me is what Carrie as a character and as a narrative is like. And for the reasons that you've already laid out, like, she didn't ask for this. She was primed for this to happen. And the ultimate tragedy is that it has to happen. My heart shatters for her every time she expresses her vulnerability, because we know how this is going to wind up. And the book, again, it being this kind of like hybrid between a short story and a novel, this book tells us bad things are going to happen from the get-go. There is no mystery other than how bad is it going to be. But we know it's going to be bad. We know, you know, within like the first two pages, there's even reference to like one of her few surviving classmates or something. Like, so we know like the whole school is going to go. We know the whole town is going to go. And we're pretty sure she's going to die too. So these moments where she says things like, you know, of course, you know, I'm going to say yes. Or, you know, that heartbreaking moment when Tommy might be standing her up and she's just waiting for him to show up. And then he does. And all she can say is like, do you like me? Mm. And like, it's like, that's not even the point, Carrie. Like,
I know.
Oh God, I wish you weren't feeling. And then to see her blossom in the prom setting, she does great. She's fucking bantering. She's so comfortable. And you get this horrible, tragic taste of how well she could fit in if she didn't have, for whatever reason, this pheromonal Scarlet A, the Scarlet C stamped on her fucking forehead. And, you know, what feels arguable to me is like, maybe you can look at her going back and taking vengeance as, you know, her finally giving as much as she's gotten and it being a moment of empowerment. Or is it the moment where she finally becomes her fucking mother? And like, this is what we were all scared of. And she's like, she's spouting pseudo biblical references here. And she's casting judgment on everybody. And she's going to die for it. And she knows she's going to die for it. And all we can do is fucking witness it and look in horror at this. You know, again, I'm going to sound a little cute, but I don't mean it cute. I think this is one of the powers of this story, is the fucking cycle of it all. Like, it is just happening again and again. Like, we live in fucking Margaret White's America right now. And like, the book ends with another telekinetic child. And there's just this feeling of like, fuck, we're going to keep bullying. We're going to keep subjugating. We're going to keep judging and torturing. And we're going to keep getting paid back for it. And it's just going to keep happening again and again and again.
The point where maybe you're like, oh, we've gone beyond rage into calculation and punishment is when she destroys the fire hydrants so that the fires can't be put out. And it's like, all right, she's no longer reacting. She's now acting. And I think in any story ever told, there is a fundamental and important difference between reaction and action. There is in life, right? You know, Crimes of Passion. You know, cold-blooded, you know, it makes that one degree is 99% of the ethical difference. And she destroys the fire hydrant so she can burn that town to the ground. But I'm still cheering her on, if I'm honest. And I think the big thing is that, like, we're all saying tragic. Well, actually, we're not all saying tragic. What do you think, Ali? Is it a story of tragedy or a story of empowerment? Or can it be both or neither?
I think it's both because, for me, Carrie is a feminist hero who is killed by the patriarchy. You know, and
a feminist hero, not feminist victim, a feminist hero.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not trying to catch you out. I'm just genuinely asking if that's, yeah, I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the word I would use. I think I can think of so few examples outside of Carrie where I got to see a woman get real angry and fuck shit up. And regardless of whether or not she pays for it, like, it's just not something you often see. Like, women are always the level-headed ones. We're always the calm ones. We always calm men down. And this is just the exact opposite of that. This is an angry girl, and she's going to have her revenge. And I love it. I do.
Well, I mean, as some, we have someone who wrote a book about a woman who just absolutely fucks shit up. We've got Nat over here.
Yes,
you know,
yes, we do.
I'm assuming all of this was an actual active engine chugging away for you, Nat, when you were writing Mary.
Oh, 100%. When I first started working and, like, outlining the final version of Mary, the version that is the one that was published, because I first started writing Mary when I was like 13. So not that version, but this final version. I even initially was imagining it being kind of like Liz Phair's Exile in Guyville, which is like a track by track response to the Rolling Stones' Exile on Main Street. So I have a document that's an outline of every chapter in Carrie.
Okay.
And I was like, I'm going to have every chapter kind of correspond to what happens in Carrie. I eventually then was like, no, I don't like that. That makes the book too beholden to Carrie. Like, I wanted Mary to be its own thing. But I was wrestling with, you know, this conversation that we're having right now, because I wanted it to be exactly like Ali is describing. I wanted it to be a narrative where a woman got to fuck shit up and I wanted it to be almost unambiguously empowering, because for me, Carrie, again, is about cycles. It's about the cyclical patriarchal abuse and the way that it creates this environment in which everyone is harmed by it, but especially the women. But we're all paying for it. And I wanted Mary being about menopause to, again, sounds cute, but it was definitely my MO. I wanted that to be about the ending of a cycle.
Yeah.
I wanted that to be about the cycle stopping. In the earlier drafts of Mary, she even kills herself. She dies. And I spoiler for Mary. Sorry, everybody. But that doesn't happen. Like, there is still, I still wanted to acknowledge the kind of discrepancy between white characters and characters of color, and how those stories don't always end the way that they should, and be as triumphant as they should. So there's that kind of, like, you know, skeptical eye to the concept of white feminism at the end of Mary. But I wanted it to be an unambiguous feminist sort of vibe. The only time I ever kind of hedge saying feminist or anything like that is, you know, whether or not this story is worthy of that label. But to me, I wanted it to be as worthy of that label as I could make it. And yeah, so it was very much investigating the role of villain, the role of hero, the role of martyr, the role of tragic figure in this sort of context.
And for those who want to know more about Mary, Nat was on episode 101 to talk about that, and you can listen to that, and you should definitely read the book, because it's all of this plus cults and really scary bathroom ghosts. So yeah, enjoy that.
thank you.
A few things you said, both of you, about, you know, hero, about martyr, about all of these things. It's really, really challenging to read Carrie in an era of terrorism. Because she's a one-woman terrorist cell. And the horror she rains down on Chamberlain, it's like a small-town 9/11. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's apocalyptic in microcosm. And And we sympathize with her. We do. I mean, no one reads this book and goes, oh, this is a book about how she's a monster to be killed. If you read the book in that way, you've read the book wrong. I think the book has to make us reflect, that's the right word, reflect on how we give ourselves the leeway to empathize with individual characters, but so simply make binary distinctions, ethical distinctions between different groups. And it's the power of story.
The original ending of the book, which Bill Thompson has described, is fascinating, and I think gets at what you're saying, where King's first draft, the draft that Bill bought for Doubleday, Carrie leaves the prom and starts destroying the town and becomes a giant with a huge head with horns bursting out of her skull. She brings a plane down. It's like literally like a Godzilla attack
right
on the town. And the editor was like, it's great up until this point. Because like you need it to be small scale. Yeah. You need it to be this story between people and this girl who has been pushed to the edge and who, yes, like makes a conscious choice to become the agent of destruction. And make sure that this town is fucking razed to the ground. But she can't be inhuman. It has to be this human story. And like, I really do. I think we can argue how successful it is, the way it's depicted at the end. Like there, I sometimes struggle with how the ending is like literally, laid out and portrayed with text. Like it does become very impressionistic. It becomes very, swirling and almost like psychedelic in a way, and you get the King's first attempt at the mind library and all these things and Sue being in her head and all the parentheses and no mama no and it becomes kind of a swirl, and like, you know, I know it's sacrilege to ever say that the movie is better in a King adaptation. I'm not saying De Palma's is better, but I think the ending of the movie, you know, crucifying Margaret White. Mm. And the house just coming down on her. Like, I think that gets to a very primal and profound truth of this story in a very palpable way. But regardless of the success of the way the climax is portrayed in the book, like, I think the intent behind it is absolutely what it needs to be. Like, this is a story of humans, and the fact that Sue winds up having this moment of connection with Carrie. The fact that they get to share a headspace for a little while, I think is so, so beautiful. It is so profound. It is a weird, like, mirror image of the Ritual of Chud, like appropriate to our previous conversation. Like, it really is like this biting down on each other's tongues and just making eye contact with this thing that we're afraid of being. And how we are not so different after all.
Yeah. You've got me, when you made me think about Rage in comparison to Carrie, the book Rage, just how interesting it is that King wrote in the 70s two books that are about the boogeyman of Western democracies, particularly America, you know, the school shooter, and through my reading of Carrie, essentially the martyring terrorist. And how much the world has changed that I don't think you could have those books written with anywhere near the same degree of empathy these days. Like you said, it's Margaret White's America.
It is Margaret. Yeah. And that's it. I mean, I almost find it interesting, that you read it from like that kind of terroristic, place. Cause to me, like, there's something very stochastic about it. There's something like, I don't know if it's just from like being entrenched in America and the fucking, you know, conservative values that are, and those are in quotes, that are like thrust upon us at all time. But like, to me, it feels less of a story of terrorism and more of just like I guess maybe we're saying the same thing. To me, it like reads like the poisonous terror of religious dogma and, you know, especially that sort of evangelical oppression that is always just barely under the surface in a lot of American culture. You know, which is another thing that King is always very focused on, as you referenced, like with Mrs. Carmody and stuff like that. Like I read this book and I think of trans bands, and I think of the fight over women having bodily autonomy, and just like this very fucking oppressive evangelical regime that is constantly trying to keep its boot on all of our necks, basically.
Well, let's finish with the best character in the book, Margaret White. My favorite character in Carrie, Margaret White. I just find her unbelievably disturbing. Just awful. I mean, she is Mrs. Carmody. They even use the word expiation a lot, you know, which I...
expiation! Yeah,
which I love. But you both sort of went, when I said my favorite character. So,
she's who you empathize with? She's who you love?
No. Catherine to hell, but I think she's a wonderful, wonderful villain. But over to you, reactions to Margaret White.
I mean, she's awful. she's awful. Like, and it really, like, I find so much of this book, like, just absolutely heartbreaking. And those moments where she's just ranting at Carrie, and Carrie's only response is to say, "I love you, Mama." It just breaks me. Like, it just absolutely breaks my heart. Like, I just want someone to love this child. And it's definitely not going to be her mom.
So. No, I have a particular fondness for her dark, twisted scripture, because, again, another thing I picked up on for the first time, it's all bullshit.
It is all bullshit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the whole serpent story, when she's like, I was like, no, that's not what happened. that's not the story. It was eating the apple.
At one part, she uses a bit of Lovecraft. At one point, she prays to the three-lobed burning eye, which is a famous description from a Lovecraft story. And I'm like, oh, King is having fun with this. But yeah. I find that house one of the most oppressive places in all of King's fiction. I don't want to go there. I don't want to be in it anymore.
Yeah.
I think what adds a little element of fun to it, though, for me at least, I don't know about you two, is that, you know, it's so hard to divorce these sort of stories that are so iconic as movies also, and Piper Laurie is so fucking iconic as Margaret White. But every time I read this book, I'm always tickled at how different she is in the book. Because not only is she described as, you know, just like physically larger, but she's this drooling maniac in the book who is a flagellant. Like, she's tearing furrows into her. She's constantly beating herself. And like, there's historical precedence in that sort of, you know, again, flagellant sort of religion. But she's this whirling dervish of fucking insanity that it's melodramatic. I mean, there's so much melodrama in this book to begin with, but it's so fucking over the top that I totally agree with you that I don't want to be there. I don't want to be in her presence. But like, witnessing it, it doesn't have that like same like really unnervingness that Piper Laurie brings to the character, which is like, oh, I've seen this woman on the street. Like, she works at a laundromat. Like, I've probably interacted with Piper Laurie's Margaret White. But the book Margaret White is just like, holy shit. She's this like rolling cannonball of just spit and fire. Which again, like for me, is again why I find this book to be so fucking tragic. And that because when Carrie goes on her tear, she also starts spouting this pseudo-biblical nonsense.
I had not picked up on this at all. This has passed me by that there's a risk she's becoming her mother. I just had not grasped that.
It's when she's like, when she decides to kill all the town citizens outside of the church, and she's talking about how, like, you know, God is even afraid of her.
Yeah.
And like, she is now an instrument of God's wrath. And starts
the whole fiery sword
comparing
thing.
It to, yeah, you
know, Mama's angry sword.
Yeah. And for me, like, so that's what makes her turning into the monster so tragic. Like, to me, if I had to sum this book up in one word, it's rebellion. It's like, that's the beauty of this book, is the rebelliousness of it. You can even look at like the patriarchal sort of ideological myth of menstruation to begin with. You know, it's you're feeling pain because you didn't serve your role as a broodmare. You didn't get pregnant mm-hmm. this month. So of course you have to hurt. That's the way Margaret White's scripture writ large kind of looks at the fertile cycle anyway. And so it's so tragic to me that that Carrie kind of becomes an embodiment of that in her thoughts. I think if she didn't have those brief allusions to biblical destruction, mm-hmm. it might not hurt as much. And I think it's nice that like the book ends with Sue realizing that she's not pregnant and having her period. It's a nice little touch. She's failed the patriarchy.
Yeah, that is a weird thing, right? Because it finishes where Sue thinks she might be pregnant, which one presumes is, you know, a nightmare scenario, because clearly her and Tommy are not going to last even before he gets killed. You know, and she knows they're not going to last. And she's missed her period. And this whole thing about not wanting this, you know, suburban 2.4 kid existence. And then the final, trying to find it in my book, but the final thing from Sue, when she's walking away from all this destruction, her rapid breathing slowed, caught suddenly as if on a thorn, and suddenly vented itself in one howling, cheated scream as she felt the slow course of dark menstrual blood down her thighs. The word cheated is strange that I don't get. Is it that she knows Tommy's gone and therefore she's lost the last chance of something that is his? Why is she cheated? Because surely the last thing she wants is a pregnancy in the wake of this absolute disaster, right? I don't understand that word choice.
Yeah, it's a weird word choice. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, I don't get it either. I have no idea what she would have been cheated.
No.
Huh.
TalkingScaredPod@gmail.com, Stephen. Let us know what was
why was it set in 1979 and why is Sue cheated?
Yeah. The last thing I'll ask about all of this is I have a theory that everyone in this book is a victim. Everyone. I said originally everyone is in the book is a victim except for Billy. But then you find out Billy is very much a victim of his home life. And oh, another really weird bit. Sorry, I'm just going into like the absolute minutiae here. But when Carrie kills Billy and Chris, she makes their car crash and you get the impression they burn to death. Fair play. There's a bit where her mind is melding with their mind and fragments of their thoughts are coming through. And you hear Chris thinking things, and then Billy thinks this thing where he just, the phrase, "Brucey, I want to be you," comes flashes. And the only thing we ever hear about Brucey is that Brucey is one of many, many guys who is like casually screwing Billy's mother. And I'm like, that's a whole thing that needs to be.
Oh my God, I missed that completely. Huh.
Yeah, there's a.
Huh.
Yeah. Not the most. If you haven't read this book, sorry, listeners, we've gone right off the deep end there into absolute textual close reading. I won't do that anymore. Here's my question. I think everyone is a victim, even Billy. What about Margaret? Is there any sympathy you can find in our shriveled hearts for Margaret White? Or is she just the monster?
I mean, the only sympathy that I can have for Margaret White is that she is a product of fundamentalism and it has warped her entire worldview. Like that's the only part where I'm like, I feel bad for you because you didn't have to believe any of this and you do. And now it's destroyed everything in your life. But even that, it's very tiny.
Even though like I've already rambled on about how I feel like she represents, you know, evangelical terror at writ large, like her own belief system doesn't even make sense. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't even know if she is a product of how she was raised. Like, she doesn't even want to procreate. Like, even that seems like very baffling. She's like an almost ascetic sort of isolationist who spouts nonsense. Like, if she's a victim of anything, I totally agree. It's like she's a victim of mental illness. and like, I don't think she has the wherewithal to be any different. We're never given the sense that like this was at any point a choice. Like, it's like she's just like a force of nature. She's also described very animalistically. Mm-hmm. Like, he compares her to a bull alligator. She also gets compared to a frog. Like, this is just what she is. So yeah, if she's a victim of anything other than her own madness, I don't know what it is. I definitely don't feel empathy for her. I don't like her. I wouldn't vote for her.
I don't like her, but I can find a reservoir of sympathy for her.
Hmm.
I think she's just a cheated, disappointed woman who has nowhere to put her anger. And I think reading between the lines, and it's up for debate this, but reading between the lines, I think she is a victim of sexual assault by her supposedly Bible-thumping dead husband. And I'm also, last thing I'm saying, I'm not convinced the girder that fell out of the sling and killed Carrie's dad was an accident. It feels, I don't know. There's a whole thing about stuff being recessive towards end. Now Margaret White's grandmother had the gene, now Carrie's got it, and that obviously Margaret doesn't. But a girder slips out of its harness and kills her rapist husband, and I'm not convinced that Margaret White wasn't standing at the construction site gates that day thinking hard thoughts. I don't know.
That, you know what? I'm gonna add one other empathetic thing for Margaret too, because you got me thinking. She also doesn't kill her baby, and she thinks about it, and she's like just psychotic enough that I would believe her to be capable of that, but she doesn't. And like there is I think a kernel of a need for connection in there. Like she didn't want to be alone. She wanted this baby, even though she knew from it floating its bottle in the crib that it was a demon baby. Like, there is something to that. So maybe we can be Libras about this. we can find some ground to love her on.
So that's the point we've reached. After an hour and 47 minutes, bonus points for not killing your baby. Well done, Margaret. Yeah, okay.
True motherhood.
Anything else? Any errata that I haven't asked about that you want to bring up? Any pressing things you want to talk about? The young Stephen King's tit obsession, maybe. You know, his need to describe every female character's...
It's a lot of tits in this
budding
book.
Boobs, yeah.
Small tits, big tits. Yeah.
Swinging tits.
I remember being in my early 20s. I empathise, Stephen. It's It's as ever, it's been a pleasure. We've talked a great deal. Found an awful lot to dissect in such a short novel. And I will say, Stephen, if you are listening, probably not, but if you are, massive congratulations on the anniversary. You almost certainly don't care, but what a start to a career it is. And Ali and Nat will probably be back here next year for a trip to Jerusalem's Lot, I'd imagine.
Nice. Let's do it.
I won't say no to a good time.
What have you guys got coming up book-wise? Ali, talk us still about Broken Dolls, because the world knows about Broken Dolls because of Stephen King.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm actively writing it, so, you know, no pressure there. Yeah. But so I am like at the end revisions on Broken Dolls. It's going to go to my editor, and then it's going to go to Stephen King, which is bonkers. And then it will be published in 2025. So that's exciting and, you know, terrifying, because I am nobody and Stephen King wants to read my book, which is weird.
What has that actually felt like? Because, I mean, obviously, apart from the good stuff is obvious, right? The excitement, that's obvious, but... You're still writing it.
Yeah.
Has it added, I'm assuming it's galvanized you, but has it also made you go, oh, shit.
Oh, the imposter syndrome is running mad. Oh, yeah, fully. I mean, like, I know that I know what I'm doing, and I'm excited about this book. And this was also, like, you know, this book is all about grief, and I didn't feel like I was ready to write this book yet, but this is the one the publisher wanted. So it's also like, on top of that, I'm working through my own grief, writing a book about grief that Stephen King wants to read. So it's a lot. There's a lot happening on those writing mornings, but yeah.
Well, we all look forward to it very much.
It's so exciting.
Everyone's rooting for you. You've got all of horror, like Twitter, rooting for you every time he retweets it. So
I know, which is awesome.
You've also got a lot of people deep down going, you bitch. But in a good way, right? Yeah. Drink their tears, Ali. Drink them. What about you now? What's I've lost track on what's next for you, because you've got a novella coming out, and then you're also working on your next novel, which is The Terminator Meets It.
Mm.
That's right. That's right. Meets Firestarter.
Okay.
So that's in there too. Meets Ooh. The Twilight Zone. Yeah, if Mary was what if Carrie turns 50 and Nestlings was what if Salem's Lot happened in a apartment building in New York, then my next book is like what if It and Terminator 2 had a baby. I have a novella coming out in October of this year, and that'll be with Shortwave Books, which I'm very excited about. And that's just a very like gnarly, the comps are Gerald's Game meets Green Room. I just wanted to try my hand at a little extreme horror. Mm. But then this very ambitious novel of Pennywise the Terminator, which it's nothing like that. Those are just kind of the thematic comps. That comes out, I think, April of 2020.
What's the title?
Nice.
It is called When the Wolf Comes Home.
Ooh, great title.
It was originally going to be titled Wolf at the Door, but then Nightfire was like, Tor just published a collection of short stories by Gene Wolfe called Wolf at the Door. So you got to have a new title.
I think When the Wolf Comes Home is a better title.
I
think
do
Wolf
too.
At the Door is relatively sort of, not generic, but it's a phrase that we're all comfortable with. When the Wolf Comes Home, that makes you go, hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. And is it a big book, or did I read something which is actually your shortest book?
This is, the first draft didn't even hit 88,000 words. Now it's probably going to be around 94 or so. I made a joking comment that, Mary was my response to Carrie, and it's at least twice as long as Carrie. And Nestlings is also a response to Rosemary's Baby, and it's at least twice as long as Rosemary's Baby. This is a response to It, and it's like an eighth the length of It. So yeah, it's it is my attempt at writing an airport novel. Like I wanted like a thriller, like a Dean Koontz sort of. For anyone who thought that Mary and Nestlings were slow burn, this is just like, all right, fuck you. This is just set piece after set piece. So it's a lot of fun. It's also a fucking pain in the ass to revise right now. So that's mainly what I'm doing.
Well,
I feel your pain, Ellie. It's the worst.
Except for when I'm drafting, because then drafting's the worst. Now that I'm revising,
drafting is also the worst. Turns
it's
out writing is just the worst.
It's just so much torture.
Well, by the time this goes live, I'll hopefully have got to a substantial way through my book about possession turned very much on its head.
Ooh.
Ooh.
I'm describing it as The Exorcist meets E.T.
Oh.
That's all I shall say.
Fuck yeah.
You're going into your deepest fears here.
Seriously. This is my thing. Fuck it. We've talked for an hour 54. I could talk for a few more minutes. There's a band I love called Spanish Love Songs, and they have a song called Haunted, and there's a verse in it that the line is, "You're not haunted, it's just the devil in your skin.
Ooh.
It will be this bleak forever, but that is a way to live." And I think it's the most disturbing thing. It's the idea that things can be dreadful and you won't die.
Yeah.
They won't kill you. And that's horrifying. And I started thinking, like, what if someone was possessed and there wasn't an exorcism for whatever reason? The most frightening thing I can think of. Somehow that has become a sort of Rachel Harrison-esque horror comedy. That's what I'm currently writing. Yeah. And hopefully I'll have got some way the way through it by the time people
hear
this.
Exciting.
Let's save the excitement for the time actually write the end, because listeners have been here before. They've been on this journey with me about, I'm writing this, and I just blame you people for writing books I want to talk about, and then I make it your fault. So yeah, let's see if I finish the damn thing. But hopefully, yeah, hopefully I will, and I'll have people ready to read it. So, yeah.
Well, if it's not long enough to be a novel, you know what you can do? Well, throw some fucking articles and AP and Esquire articles, yeah, and interviews and pat transcripts.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Yeah, well, we'll see how it goes. But I'm very excited for both your books. I'm just going to say briefly, listeners, if you this is your intro to the show, or you haven't listened to the episodes with Ali and Nat in the past, their stuff is amazing. And I'm not saying it because they're my friends and on the show. They are, and they are. But honestly, you just have to look at my reviews and things I've said to know I'm telling the truth. Ali's written a book called This Appearing House, which is kind of if Neil Gaiman wants to rip your throat out.
Oh, put that on a t-shirt.
Yeah. Imagine a girl with cancer goes into the No End House or into the Davidson Amazing House of Leaves and deals with the monsters therein. It's a fucking brilliant book for your kids and for you. Nat has written, as we discussed, Mary and Nestlings, both the kinds of books that we say they don't write like that anymore, and we want more of them. And Nat has written them, and they are frankly fabulous. And I think, you know what, Nat? I think we overplay the, oh, Stephen King comparisons. After a while, it becomes a disservice, I think. What I will say is you write very much tonally in terms of building characters before you do awful things to people. But I don't want people thinking, oh, he's just doing Stephen King, because it's very much its own thing, and they're great.
Oh, well, thank you.
So everyone, listen to these guys' previous episodes, and for God's sake, read their books. And thank you for listening. And Nat, Ali, thank you for talking Scared.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Neil.
Happy birthday, Carrie.
Happy birthday, Carrie!
We'll be your friend. Don't kill us.